and that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, motivated by the new film In a World, we'll talk about the world of the voiceover and the movie that's trying to uncover its deep and resonant undertones. We'll take one of your suggestions and consider how personnel changes affect the moment when a band ceases to be even a shadow of its former self. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and pop culture and other ephemera, which means I assigned the review of In a World.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
So we all saw In a World. Now, this is a film directed by the actress Lake Bell, who also stars in it. She wrote it. She directed it.
She produced it.
She is it, and it is she. And she stars in it as a young woman who is trying to get a foothold in the voiceover industry. Her father is a legendary voiceover artist. And the big story involves the new trailer for a new adventurous film where they are bringing back the trailer opening expression, In a World.
Do each of us get a crack at this?
I don't know. Trey already did his.
I sort of feel like
I got to hear everybody's now.
In a World.
That's pretty good.
Nice.
This is good, Thompson. Yeah, normally you're not that resonant.
just in general.
Only in my heart.
Aww.
Glenn, go ahead.
In a World.
Oh, that's pretty good, too. Yeah. That's pretty good, too. I can't do it because I'm a woman. Whoa!
Oh.
Getting into the theme of the movie. I'm just kidding. Into the theme of the movie. One of the themes of the movie, of course, is that the vast majority of voiceover artists are men. So let's start with Trey. What did you think of this movie?
I think it was nice that you said she is it and it is she, because I actually find the movie really charming, smart, funny, loose.
What is Lake being Bell. Implied here?
You it's are loose.
Not that loose. Just loose in its rhythms. It's not trying to be anything more than it is. It is agreeable. It takes its time doing what it wants to do. And it's kind of, I guess, loosey-goosey. Where have I heard that? Somebody said loosey-goosey to me recently and, you know.
Now it's the only word stuck in my head.
Now it's the only thing you can think of is loosey-goosey. So you enjoyed it.
I did.
Stephen, how about you?
You know, I liked it whenever it was focused largely on her. Mm-hmm. I felt like she had a really nice understanding of her. I'm going to keep saying world, and I'm going to feel like I should say it a certain way. Mm-hmm. But I felt like when it drifted beyond her world, the movie felt a little more formless. I didn't feel like she had as firm a grasp on the lives of, for example, the boys' club of the sort of stodgy, successful voice actors. I felt like they were very cartoonishly rendered.
Okay.
And I was not as drawn to them. There's a whole subplot with her sister and her sister's husband that's, while compelling, doesn't have necessarily that much to do with going on. I felt loosey-goosey is a bit of a double-edged sword with this movie. I liked it. I rooted for it. I rooted for her. I liked her. But the film, I felt like there wasn't a lot of movie there.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you slightly here, because this is a film that knows its assets extremely well. It knows that Lake Bell is charming, but not sort of cloyingly, like, rom-com charming.
Right.
It knows that Rob Corddry and Michaela Watkins, if you've got these guys in your movie, you should focus on them. You should devote some screen time to
them. The sister and the husband.
The sister and the husband. Because they can take what you give them, and they can push a little bit farther than we've seen either of these two actors do, dig a little bit deeper. They know that Ken Marino is a great that guy. Under special skills on his little resume, I'm sure it says, like, horseback riding accents and being sleazy, because that's what he does.
If you haven't seen him in The Bachelor Takeoff, Burning Love,
it's so good.
You really need to watch Burning Love.
It knows.
By which I mean, Stephen, you need to watch Burning Love.
It knows that if you've got a movie this crowded and you also have Tig Notaro and Nick Offerman, you need to keep them sort of in reserve to do little surgical strikes, to be funny in and out and not.
Yeah, they have very small parts. They're just brought in, they do drive-bys.
Exactly. And that's an excellent use of them in this case. And it also knows that I was getting a little worried because the chemistry between Lake Bell and one of her romantic interests in the film, Dimitri Martin, seemed very brother-sister. Mm-hmm. But then the film becomes about that and how they address that. So that was really smart.
Yeah.
So as a feat of resource management, awesome. my thing with the movie is that the humor is very gentle. So gentle that I could have used a few more jokes. I agree with you that the dad gets a little cartoonish.
Yeah.
But you notice it because the rest of this film is so determined to flesh out its characters and make them real and not cartoonish, which in comedy is not necessarily always a great impulse. You do need to push it a little bit, and it didn't always do that. But ultimately, I just thought this was a really smart, funny film.
I'm not entirely positive that the film is committed to making them real or fully rounded characters. I think it is committed to being kind to them.
I thought you were going
to
say Lucy.
Everybody,
no, I think that's, I think that's right.
Everybody who is initially set up as a villain or a stereotype or a laughable character, like, say, the one she calls the groupie, the father's much younger girlfriend.
They do nice things with that character.
They turn out to be more interesting, kinder, more complicated than you initially suspect.
She does a nice job of, in the beginning of the film, and this isn't giving anything away, of, in the beginning of the film, judging harshly, for example, women who speak in high-pitched baby voices.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever get a smoothie around here?
I'm sorry, I'm not...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
I said I don't know where you'd get a smoothie around here at all. I'm so sorry.
Oh, okay, thanks so much.
Yeah, no worries.
Lake Bell does a lot of dialects, a lot of accents. That's the film establishes that that's her specialty, is not necessarily the deep intonation voiceover, but she's very, very good at studying different quirks of voices. And I like the way that over the course of the film and she become more sympathetic toward people with somewhat mockable voices and sort of gets to another side of that in a way that's loving. I think maybe my biggest performance-wise complaint about the film is that the guy they've cast as her father clearly, you know, is a voice...
Fred Melamed.
Yeah, is a voice actor himself, and there's a difference between voiceover and acting.
Right.
Well, now, let's give this guy credit. She cast him not knowing that he was a voice actor.
Really?
She cast him because of his performance in A Serious Man.
The Jolly Roger is quite livable. It's not expensive. The rooms are eminently habitable.
This would allow you to visit the kids.
There's convenience in its favor. You've got a pool.
Wouldn't it make more sense for you to move in with Cy?
Harry.
Larry, you are jesting.
And then she discovered after the fact that he had been a voice actor for 20 years. So, this guy's got some chops, and he specifically has some chops in the realm of playing characters who are a little selfish, a little self-centered, a little egotistical, but turn out to be kind of nice.
What was that great, that Russian Star Wars thing you used to do as a kid?
Yeah, I know the one you're talking about. But, Dad, can we...
No, what was it?
It was... don't make me do it right now.
Come on.
I don't want to do it right now.
Please, let me hear it.
These are not the droids you're looking for.
I just love that. It's so random. Yeah.
Which is exactly who this character is.
Yeah. One of the things I like about this film, it has, as Glenn mentioned, this romantic subplot between her and Dimitri Martin, who I really like as a romantic interest because he's not an expected sort of person. He's the sort of person, as Glenn mentions, where you see him in the movie and typically he's going to be the friend. He's going to be the other guy. He's usually not the guy. He's usually the other guy. So I like the fact that they go ahead and sort of explore that relationship. I like him in it very much.
Mm-hmm. I do.
And just as a side note, I only discovered his stand-up recently. And I'm quite picky about stand-up albums, which ones I want to listen to. He has some terrific stuff. He has a record that I think is actually called Stand Up Comedian. And it's really funny. And I've been listening to it on Spotify. And I definitely recommend it. So, but in terms of her as a character in a romantic plot, where it has parts about her kind of dating life. First of all, there are some unexpected beats in that story, where sort of the declarations don't necessarily go in the way that you think they're going to. And there's a little bit of an unevenness and a kind of jaggedy quality to that story. But I also feel like one of the most important things that's often missing from especially women in romantic comedy is a life outside of boyfriends and a kind of generic career. Like, I work in publishing. Like, I love the fact that this movie establishes her early on as this obsessive about voices.
Yeah.
That she kind of follows people around with tape recorder trying to get little snippets of voices. And anytime you give a character, I think, something that they are passionate about, that they care about.
That is not boys.
That isn't boys, and it isn't something like really obvious, like she makes cupcakes. Like, not that there's anything wrong with cupcakes, but we've sort of seen that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
This, to me, was a different brand of obsessive interest in a career and a calling and something that she clearly is really good at and understands. And yet it also comes off as a quirk. And that's a hard balance. And I liked the fact that they kind of gave her that to establish her as a character.
I think that's very close to who, like, Belle is in real life. I mean, in addition to the work she does on shows that Glenn likes, what's it called, Children's Hospital?
Children's Hospital.
which she also has directed episodes of, mm-hmm. apparently. She does those voices. In this film, she does the voice of the agent that Gustav, the third contender for voiceover champ. She does the voice of the agent he's always talking to on the phone. And she tells a story in an interview with Terry Gross on Fresh Air from, I think, last week. She tells a story about how when she was little, she was doing silly voices all the time and silly accents. So, I mean, this is just kind of close to the bone for her. And I think that informs the writing and the characterization.
Yeah. The other thing I like about her is it's really difficult to be a pretty woman in a romantic comedy who is capable of seeming like a person that everyone wouldn't necessarily regard as the prettiest girl they know.
Sure.
There is a quality to the way she presents herself in this movie where, like, look, don't get me wrong, she's a very pretty lady.
Yeah.
But she's able to seem like a normal person in a way that is acting. It's not makeup, and people think it's makeup and hair and you put glasses on and mess up the it's part of being able to put down being glamorous is acting. And I looked at her and I thought, you can believe looking at her that this could be a person that you could know in your life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who would be just kind of kicking around and having jobs and doing stuff and trying to figure everything out. And that's tough to accomplish. A lot of times it's so studied and you feel like somebody is trying so hard to sell that it doesn't work at all. And mm-hmm. I thought she did an unusually good job of selling that.
Right. It will be interesting to see if she's cast, like, just as an actress in more romantic comedies. She is good in this.
And she's played the best friend a couple times in romantic comedies.
Yeah.
I do think it's interesting that this movie should come out now, because I actually kind of, I wonder if voiceovers are as pervasive as they used to be. My sense is that they're not.
Right. Mine is too, at least in trailers.
Yeah.
I think a lot of trailers don't use them at all anymore. It's just clips from the movie
true.
And booming music.
And text on the screen. And I wonder if it may be more that we're so conscious of them these days. I mean, this movie is all about the art of the voiceover, right? And how they manipulate you. These days, when I go to a movie and you get one of these big old-fashioned voiceovers, it's either a deliberate joke.
Right.
Or it's done so poorly that the audience giggles at the excess of it.
I think that's a great point. I think that, in general, I mean, Don LaFontaine, the legendary voice actor who's died within the last few years, who is a clear, he is partly the inspiration for mm-hmm. the plot mechanics of In a World, his death. You know, who is going to be given the opportunity to say In a World in a trailer? I mean, when Don LaFontaine was alive, he did a Geico commercial that they show in the beginning of this movie.
Yeah.
Actually, let's hear a moment of it.
Paula Sela is a real Geico customer, not an actor. So to help tell her story, we hired that announcer guy from the movies.
When the storm hit, both our cars were totally underwater.
In a world where both of our cars were totally underwater,
we thought it would take forever to get some help.
But a new wind was about to blow.
That Geico commercial is parodying how familiar mm-hmm. those beats are.
Absolutely.
And yeah, you don't get as many voiceovers and trailers. And I think in general it may be just a general move from, you know, as things become tropes, there's more and more of a push to show rather than tell.
Right. Well, one of the themes of the film is this whole idea of the voice of God.
Right.
And I think we have a different relationship to trailers, especially as some person telling us, you know, what we should expect. I mean, the convention is to use voiceover sparingly in a film or a television show, for that matter, usually at the beginning and sometimes at the end. And mm-hmm. they tend to vanish in the middle. But they establish mood. They are often used to establish character, particularly in a lot of these sort of lighter films, these quirky films where you'll see, like, in the film Warm Bodies used this. We see a zombie and we hear, "That's me," you know, like, so it's that there's the "that's me" school of
right.
Of
but frequently, thing. That's the actor from the movie.
Right. Well, yeah,
right. You're not saying. Talking about a.
I'm talking about the technique,
but you're not talking about a disconnected voiceover right. for a voiceover.
Well, there's
say.
Voice. There's voiceover and there's narration.
Right. And narration is how it's often used.
Right.
But, I mean, we should define our terms here because narration is storytelling, and it's slightly different. I mean, the voiceover is the technique, and it can be used by a disembodied voice, the voice of God, or it can be used often by a character in the film.
Right. And I do think people who do this specifically, people who do voiceovers that aren't exactly acting, they're more announcing or whatever— I do think that's used more in commercials now
right.
than it is in trailers. Mm-hmm. You still see the kind of stuff, like there's a moment in the film when she's working on a shampoo commercial. Like that kind of stuff still happens
yep.
for sure. I think in terms of whether it's used in trailers as much, I think it's not. But I think you'd find...
In commercials, it's a lot. And actually, I listened to Lake Bell interviewed on the podcast Bullseye with Jesse Thorne.
Yes.
And she talks about the difference between... when you are trying to sell, for example, a car versus trying to sell tampons
mm-hmm.
and how, you know, and she talks about the difference between be like me or be with me,
right.
you know, in terms of the ideal that you're trying to set up with your voice. And so I do think, yeah, commercials in general have much, much, much
yeah.
more use for voiceover than trailers do.
And I do think that there is some truth to the fact that generic voiceovers still tend to overwhelmingly be men's voices.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about stuff like, you know, if you were watching Breaking Bad and the voice that said on next week's Breaking Bad was a woman, you'd be really surprised. You would think
yeah.
that they were trying to make some particular kind of point, despite the fact that that voice doesn't represent any of those characters. I mean, every now and then they use a person from the show in something like that.
Yeah, and oftentimes they will.
But if they're not, It's the generic voice is still going to be a dude, like, you know, coming to AMC and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's still going to be a dude 90% of the time, I would say, at least.
And every once in a while it jumps out. There was some, oh, was it Showtime, where the voice of Showtime for a while was Penn Jillette?
Comedy Central.
Comedy Central. Oh, it was Comedy Central. You're right. And so you would suddenly have Penn Jillette telling you what was coming up, and it was distracting because you knew who he was.
It's funny the way that works. Sometimes it's distracting. Sometimes it's there, but it's not there. Like if you watch Fancy Feast and I think Norwegian Caribbean, it's Lauren Bacall. And mm-hmm. most people don't recognize that voice anymore, but it still has that purr and that sort of mm-hmm. that odd sense of luxury that works for both of those brands.
Well, and a little bit of that recognition, if you do recognize
right.
her, you feel like, smart.
Oh.
Sort of the way the music cues on NPR
sure.
will reference, you know, the music cue will reference the story, and if
mm-hmm.
you notice it, you feel smart.
There's
right.
a piece on The Dissolve last week about Terrence Malick, the filmmaker Terrence
mm-hmm.
Malick's
mm-hmm.
use of voiceover, and how over the course of his career he's allowed it to go more abstract, to create almost a parallel storyline that wasn't commenting directly on the action. You hear the actor or the actress's voice.
I call those the movies that Linda jumped off the train.
Yeah. I would say you kind of up the artsy/fartsy quotient when you do something like that, but that's fine. It's often used, classically used, to paper over plot holes. When something goes wrong
sure.
with the film,
yep.
you bring, in this case, the case I'm thinking of is the movie Blade Runner, where the initial cut of that film was deemed by the studio too confusing, not enough connections were made. So the very first thing we see Harrison Ford, then we hear him say, "Sushi, that's what my wife called me, cold fish." Now, the first sentence says a thing, and the very second sentence explains what the first sentence is. He just
yeah.
described what sushi is. So that gives you a sense of how terrible that narration is. It comes back in again at the very end of the film, and this is the director Frank Darabont, complaining about just how terrible this narration is.
Right at that moment where I'm like at my emotional crescendo as a viewer, here comes this thudding, dunderheaded voiceover.
"I don't know why he saved my life. Maybe in those last moments he loved life more than he ever had before.
Maybe, I guess, in those last moments he appreciated life more than ever before. Like, yes, I know that. Thank you. Thank you for kicking this beautiful, delicate, emotional note that we were achieving right in the nuts."
Now, see, Harrison Ford didn't want to do that. He didn't think the film needed
clearly,
it.
Clearly, you can hear that.
And you can so hear it. That is just... Now, there's a noir character to it. I mean, obviously, like, I don't object to the idea of a noir voiceover for a film like Blade Runner, because that's where
it's coming from.
It's
totally genre appropriate. You know,
my plan was to kiss her with every lip on my face. That kind of noir thing. It's from Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. That fits in, but you can just feel throughout, whenever this narration comes in, you can just feel the entire film go...
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There are definitely some... I mean, you can definitely find a lot of bad voiceover in both film and television and things where you're like, either it's not necessary or it's totally distracting or...
Well, and how often are we...
The terrible who's talking problem.
How often are we grateful? How often are we grateful that there is no voiceover in movies in general? Sort of like I'm so grateful when exposition is achieved without the aid of a newscaster.
Right. You know? Right. Absolutely.
Almost everybody knows how lazy it is at this point. I also have to throw a shout out, and Linda will know exactly where I'm going to this. My favorite word in all of summer television is at the beginning of every episode of Big Brother.
Yeah. Nick.
Previously on Big Brother. Previously.
Like, it makes me so happy.
You know the show, what? That guy has gotten more into that every year.
Well, seriously, like, the entire rest of the show is a garbage dump. And yet, that guy saying previously at the beginning just makes me so happy.
Why don't they have the host person do that? Why doesn't she do that?
What's because it's so much better.
Can you imagine Julie Chen? She's married to Les Moonves.
Yes. Yeah.
She can't say previously. She'd have to say it like a person, the way she says, but first.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again.
Well, or the way on The Bachelor, Chris Harrison always goes, gubbing up.
Gubbing up.
That's also the only thing I like about The Bachelor.
Stephen has a curiously high interest in these little reality show drop-in.
They're just like little pellets. They're like they get a Pavlovian response that probably as intended every single time.
You should come find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and let us know what you think about voiceovers and whether, of course, you've seen this particular movie. So one of you pointed out that there are times over the evolution of a band, as many know, when the band might swap out a guy. Let's say the drummer spontaneously combusts.
Exactly, mm-hmm. As one does.
And at some point you begin to think, is this still this band?
Right.
Or is this just a bunch of guys who still now own the rights to the name of this band?
Well, yeah. At what point is a band what it's called? Does it matter? Mm-hmm. At what point does... I've also seen things where the singer leaves the band, quote-unquote goes solo, and then acquires all of his previous band members.
Right, exactly.
Like, the last Glenn Hansard solo tour was all the Frames.
Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah. I've seen that happen as well.
I want to say maybe another way of framing this is, are we talking about a band or a brand?
I guess that, you know, that's a totally fair question. And I keep looking for unifying theories of at what point is it ridiculous to call the band by its original name. And one of the examples that jumped out at me is Guns N' Roses, that we waited 17 years for a new Guns N' Roses record, at which point you're basically talking about Axl Rose and an assortment of L.A. hired hands. Hired guns,
like
if you
a
will.
Studio pickup band, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, but, I mean, they're very, very talented players. They're top-notch L.A. hard rock studio musicians. But is it Guns N' Roses? And, you know, at the same time, is it more Guns N' Roses if you try to trot poor Steven Adler out?
Right.
Does it have to be the exact guys? So many of these bands in the beginning start out, like I read somewhere that I didn't even realize this, that Ann and Nancy Wilson are not original members of Heart.
Wow. What?
I did not know that.
And
who are the original members of Heart?
And that's the thing. So is
it's originally like left ventricle left the band.
So, you know, if Ann and Nancy Wilson tour as the leaders of Heart, it wouldn't be like as if you were going to see Foghat and there's like no one left or like the drummer is left.
Fog is gone. Hat is gone.
Fog. There's no fog, no hat.
This isn't Fog Hat. This is Smoke Socks. Sorry.
Wow.
All right. Okay. Smoke sucks.
And that's our episode.
I'm improvising. Give me a break.
I have a unifying theory.
Could have been steam tie. Go ahead.
Which is that when you take a B out of the BLT, you got salad. You got a salad with two flat square croutons, granted, but it's still salad. Because the beef...
You're talking about the bread is the croutons?
The bread, the slices really, of bread are two giant croutons. Follow me here.
I'm drifting farther if you know.
But there are certain bands where even though it's ostensibly a collection of musicians, it's really the guy. Uh-huh. Talking Heads is really David Byrne. When David Byrne leaves and they try to tour as Talking Heads, no.
No talking, just heads.
No talking, just heads. It doesn't work. When, let's take, you got Jefferson Airplane.
Mm-hmm.
They become Jefferson Starship.
Correct.
Then they become Starship, and then they, leave the whole music-making thing and go into urban planning and start building cities.
Right.
On rock and roll.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's true.
But see, a band like the Monkees, that was a weird alchemy where all of them got the spotlight. The spotlight kept rotating around. You wouldn't say it was all Mike Nesmith or all Davy Jones, but you take them out, and it's not
gotta
all
be
the Monkees.
There.
I mean, somebody goes to see the Monkees in the 80s at Great Adventure in New Jersey.
I feel like a story
is
coming on.
And Nesmith has better things to do.
Right.
You understand you're seeing the Monkees with an asterisk.
Yeah. Well, if you went right now to see the Beach Boys...
Yeah.
Who would you expect to see?
How many Wilsons would there
be? I do not remember who
it's
owns
like Mike
that name
Love.
Right now.
Yeah, I frankly have no idea.
I wish that our friend Mark Hirsch was here because he has followed this ridiculous story and could actually explain exactly which Beach Boys are still involved.
I believe it is Mike Love.
But it's gone back and forth between, like, sometimes it's Mike Love and a bunch of other randos and John Stamos.
John Stamos.
Seriously, John Stamos plays with the Beach Boys regularly.
The bongos.
You're all laughing.
No.
It's true.
I'm not saying it's not true.
And but I can't remember whether he's affiliated with the Mike Love part or the Brian Wilson part, because Brian Wilson still sometimes also goes out.
Right.
But I can't remember if he's the one who can't come. I mean, the problem is, to me, not just when is the band not the band, but when do people no longer know what they're going to see?
Yes.
Like, right. If you're Mike Love and you want to call yourself the Beach Boys, that's not necessarily any more bogus than Brian Wilson calling himself the Beach Boys, except creatively.
Except that he doesn't.
Except creatively. But you would want to know, like, okay, what part of the band is this? What wing of the house am I getting?
And well, there are instances, and I think this is particularly true in the sort of Motown/R&B mm-hmm. world,
right,
where a label, for instance, owns the band name.
Absolutely.
And the original people have long since departed and or died.
Yeah.
And they've assembled a new ensemble, and none of them were associated with the act originally, and they're touring it and, you know, booking in audiences based on this brand.
Speaking of,
again,
fun fact... weird fact. After Jefferson Starship was Jefferson Starship, they reformed as Jefferson Starship, the New Generation.
That's
really?
All.
Seriously.
Yeah. Wow.
Seriously.
Yeah. Well,
and you have Creedence Clearwater Revisited.
Yeah.
And the various offshoots.
That's just a cover band like ABBA.
No. Creedence Clearwater Revisited has members of, I believe, has members of Creedence Clearwater.
And I think when Trey was mentioning the Motown folks and stuff like that, I believe in the Phil Spector era of Phil Spector, those bands sort of involved whatever musicians he had handy on a
right.
given day. And you couldn't even necessarily tell. You know, Darlene Love's entire
right.
beef with Phil Spector had to do with songs being released as Crystal's records
right.
that she sang lead on.
Right.
And so there was a certain obscuring, even originally.
Yeah,
that wasn't mm-hmm. a matter of when does the band stop being the band. That's when was it ever. And when you have recording that is as opaque as Phil Spector recording sometimes could be, you know.
Yeah, that wall of sound was about more than one thing.
Right.
Yeah.
I think with some labels and as Trey was saying, some labels and some acts and stuff like that, the act is whoever the label says it is, even in the moment when it's still completely current.
Even at the time.
And so, I don't think that happens as much now, but.
Yeah, and but I mean, the fact is, if you go to any given casino and see the Four Tops or the Temptations.
Sure. There are still Four Tops and Temptations, but I don't think they have anything to do with the.
Or there's maybe one original member. It was interesting. I did a little web poking around mm-hmm. for, you know, bands with no original members. And it's fascinating when you see something like Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Mm-hmm. Like, Blood, Sweat, and Tears still exists, and its longest serving member joined in 1985.
Yeah. Mm.
And yet it is still touring as Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Well, the question becomes, though, if you constantly have overlap, right? If you replace one guy,
mm-hmm.
that band is still the same band. And then
it's like
it
your body regenerating like that, skin cells.
Well, and it's
your body
like,
turns over every 7 years.
If eventually you wind up with no original members, but you replace them one at a time,
mm-hmm.
you can understand how each one of those iterations of the band would feel it was still the band.
Mm-hmm. You're saying that it gets passed down from person to person in the manner of the epic poems.
That's exactly, I think, what she's saying. I think when Linda talks about the Little River Band not having any of its original members,
she's really thinking of Homer.
She's talking about Homer.
Yeah. So my favorite example, one of my favorite examples of this, involves the band Journey. They are about to, PBS, Independent Lens, is going to be running this fall, I think, the documentary Don't Stop Believin', which is about...
Every Man's Journey.
Every Man's Journey, which is about Arnel Pineda. Okay, so Steve Perry leaves Journey.
Yep.
They want to get the band back together and make money. Mm-hmm. Now, this is after Don't Stop Believin' has been on The Sopranos, but before it's on Glee. Okay,
wow. So this is already several iterations removed from Steve Perry, because they had the Steve Augeri era.
Absolutely. So
which I think was really their peak.
So I misspoke. Not Steve Perry leaves Journey, but Steve Perry leaves Journey and eventually... Several iterations later, they're trying to remake the band. And here's how Neil Schon goes about looking for a lead singer. He Googles or YouTube searches people singing Journey covers.
Wow.
And he finds this guy in the Philippines who sounds a little something like this.
It's uncanny.
Yeah. Right? That's
a little creepy.
I am, right?
It's a remarkable, remarkable imitation.
So they found Arnel in the Philippines, and as you can imagine, based on hearing that, Neil Schon thought, sure.
But does he have the character and the personality of a Steve Augeri?
And the nose.
So they bring him over, and they essentially bring him from bar singing in the Philippines, and he becomes the lead singer of Journey. Now, here's the question. This is nothing against other people in Journey, right?
God forbid. Do not besmirch the good name of Neil Schon.
Mr. Salahi, I have nothing against you. But if you are replacing your departed lead singer with somebody who sounds as much like your departed lead singer as possible, this is the theory that I put forth in my review of this documentary about this happening. Are you not now the world's best Journey cover band?
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
The one that is known as Journey.
See, also Judas Priest, who hired the lead singer of a Judas Priest cover band. There was a movie based on that, a fictionalized movie.
It's one thing if you decide to be like Van Halen, and you're like, now we don't have David Lee Roth anymore. We're going to get a totally different guy.
Right.
We're going to get Sammy Hagar, who has his own reputation, whatever.
Right. I actually started a tribute band that is all Gary Cherone era Van Halen.
That's a deep cut.
But it's another thing if you're like, we're just going to go out and find the guy who sounds as much like our previous guy as possible. Then you really are Journey Mania, right?
Right, exactly. Mania.
You've seen this movie, right? It is partly about that, but it's also partly about the difficulty this guy has fitting in and relating to the fans, right?
Well, right. Because, of course, now by the time, as Steven said, by the time they got this guy, they had a couple other guys. So the fans were a little bit used to the rotating merry-go-round. I think other times when bands replace any member, like, you know, the most prominent member or another member, fan revolt is always a problem.
Right.
Because at what point do fans begin to feel like they're not seeing or hearing the band that they love anymore?
Right.
Like, how many One Directions could you lose before people would be like, oh, you got to rename it?
Yeah, Menudo kind of tap danced around this problem very, very easily by just churning through.
You got to give a little bit of props to NKOTB, man, for holding together all the respective new
kids. I saw the Backstreet Boys in like 2006, long story.
I was like, do tell.
it was all the same Backstreet Boys.
Yeah.
It was, they were all still, you know,
those
as
groups
much
have
themselves
held together
as they
surprisingly
ever were.
Well, yeah.
But
yeah.
The other groups that change, I mean, I think it was the cultural critic and satirist Sherwood Schwartz who pointed out in an episode of The Brady Bunch in which Greg Brady gets a successful career as the rock god Johnny Bravo.
Yeah.
Yes.
That, in fact, they change his name to Johnny Bravo, and they revealed to him at the end that they're futzing with his song because he fits the suit.
That's right. You fit the
exactly
suit.
Right. He fit the suit.
You fit the suit. And I think there are a lot of people
penetrating,
who would say,
insightful Sherwood Schwartz.
Fans are constantly swapping in guys who fit the suit. Mm-hmm. You know? Like, what exactly are you looking for when you swap out a band? Because certainly there are bands that, I mean, basically every time Stephen and I have ever seen Glenn Hansard, he's been with a different collection of people. And it's
But largely the same. The
core
80%
is the
same. Well,
no. The core is the same. But there are times when we've seen him and he's had like four guys.
Right.
And then there was the last time we saw him when it was like Polyphonic 11. Spree. Yeah. It was like, plus like people from the audience are being invited on stage. It was like, it was some sort of kind of like Edward Sharp hippie thing happening up there. So
Linda hates Joy.
I like Joy. So, I mean, sometimes the change that you make in a band is just, do you want this array of instruments for this tour,
sure,
or this one for another tour, which is a lot easier if you don't have an underlying assumption that it's all going to be the same people all the time.
Well, I find it fascinating that REM, when drummer Bill Berry left the group, it was this gigantically traumatic experience for the band. And the band had to, in some ways, reinvent its sound. And the album Up, you know, that uses drum machines and stuff, because they just don't know what to do, mm-hmm, about the fact that their guy, their drummer, isn't, mm-hmm, in the band anymore. Like, is it still REM?
Yeah.
Is so fascinating to me when you compare that to, you know, how many, like I saw a lineup of, you know, on Wikipedia, of everyone who has ever played in Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it is literally like 140 people.
Yep. Yeah.
But REM, the nature of the relationships within that band and the relationship, clearly the nature of the collaborations within that band,
yeah,
they could not do without the drummer.
Right. I think people often make the mistake of thinking that that only applies to like the lead singer or,
yeah,
the most famous person in the band.
Yeah, and often
fact,
the lead singer doesn't write the songs. I mean, Alice in Chains,
right,
when Lane Staley died. Right. Well, the mastermind of Alice in Chains was not Lane Staley. He,
right,
just was the singer.
Right.
Right. But,
right.
But
Genesis became a totally different thing when Peter Gabriel left and was replaced.
That is true.
Replaced, air quotes. With Phil Collins.
That is true. That is very true.
It's totally different
while
genre.
While we're in that era, can we just mourn the passing of the Peter Cetera era Chicago?
Oh.
Stephen can.
Hey, man. Don't
he
you knock, don't you knock Jason Scheff, man. Jason Scheff is a national treasure.
Stephen has such strong feelings about eras of Chicago. It's so upsetting.
It's, I was.
Related, you know, we are old.
Yeah, exactly.
No,
yeah,
but it's really, it's terribly, terribly upsetting. But no, I think that it is definitely true and worth mentioning that we as civilians often misunderstand who the people are that bands cannot afford to lose.
Right.
Because,
mm-hmm,
bands,
those
feel,
internal dynamics are mysterious.
Those internal dynamics are very mysterious. And so you wind up with situations where, you know, people may be perfectly okay with going to see a band with a new drummer, but the band is completely bad,
right, for, yeah, the band.
And I guess I think
apart,
what it comes down to sort of circle back to the original question, is that it's the same band as long as there's a definable sensibility,
mm-hmm,
that equals that band, that equals that brand.
Yeah, but see, definable sensibility is almost a contradiction in terms.
But there's a no, there's a
recognizable.
There's an I know it when I hear it.
Yeah,
you know, when it's, when the essence of something is lost.
Uh-huh.
But it's also interesting, I have to say.
So you're saying Genesis was not Genesis.
Well, I do think it's interesting also when you have bands that are suddenly deemed vastly different because they've changed their name.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what they go by, like, I mean, this is relevant to me in the moment because I just reviewed this amazing new album by Volcano Choir. Which is Justin Vernon from Bon Iver and this group of friends and musicians he really loves from Milwaukee called Collections of Colonies of Bees. And their first record that came out like 4 years ago is very experimental, very avant-garde. It like takes fragments of his voices and is layering it over these weird noodlings. This new Volcano Choir record, 4 years later, if you put the name Bon Iver on it,
yes,
and I'm sorry, the first Bon Iver record is Justin Vernon.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the second Bon Iver record is Justin Vernon and like 10 people.
Right.
He could absolutely have put Bon Iver on this record and people would be losing their minds over how good it is.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, because it's called Volcano Choir, Yeah. It's like this different thing.
Yeah. And it has a whole new thing to prove.
It has a whole new thing to prove. And clearly it is a conscious gesture on his part. He's talked about, maybe I won't make any more records as Bon Iver, because he's a little uneasy with fame.
Right.
And so you have, some people are, but, you know, seriously, just because it's Volcano Choir does not mean it is not as good as a Bon Iver.
No, sure.
Right. Well, but we haven't even addressed it. It's seen a little late in the day to do it now. But, I mean, the notion of a one-man band like the National breaking up. What does that even mean?
Yeah. I've decided to dissolve myself.
You can say that you stopped, but you can't say you broke up.
I've dissolved myself.
All I know is that if Katrina ever left the waves, I think they would... would go down in flames.
Hey, man, they did.
You got tangled up in that one.
Literally, there was a band called The Heads.
Yep.
And their album was called No Talking, Just Heads.
I know, trust me. And, you know, the Gloria Estefan left the Miami Sound Machine. The Miami Sound Machine is now rusting in some Miami backyard.
Yeah, well, what can you do? So thanks for that question about when is a band no longer a band from our pal and listener, Nick Lansing. We appreciate it, Nick, and thanks for the idea. As I say every time, we like it when you come up with ideas and bring them to us, because then we don't have to think of them.
I love it.
And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what on earth could be making you happy this week?
I'm going to ask Nick Fountain to play us a few moments of a song.
Oh, good.
Jolene, Jolene, I'm begging of you, please don't take my man.
I know I'm biting Trey
you
Graham's.
You so are.
Biting Trey Graham's style here. Do you guys know exactly what that is?
I know.
It's
what
Nina
that
Simone.
Is. Yeah. I know what it
it's
is.
It's Michelle and Diego Cello.
Now, you know, this was fairly widely circulated, so this won't be news to a lot of people. But that is, of course, Dolly Parton performing Jolene at 33 RPM. So they took the 45 RPM 7-inch single of Dolly Parton's Jolene and slowed it down to 33 RPM and revealed it to be this dusky, graceful, beautiful. Like, you can, if you listen really closely, you can hear the certain way that Dolly Parton shaped her words.
Right.
You're
right. If you listen really, really closely on like the ends of phrases or the tops of a musical arch, you can hear that warble that's very distinctly Dolly.
Right.
But if you're not listening for that stuff, it is so incredibly different. And yet, as a friend of mine pointed out when I shared this on Facebook, it's slowed down so much that every single potential flaw is right out there exposed, and there aren't any flaws.
Yeah, yeah, I find I'm a big fan of these song manipulations in various iterations. One of my favorites, which I listen to when I'm editing all the time, is Justin Bieber's You Smile, slowed down from like 3 minutes and 15 seconds to 32 minutes long, and it becomes, he's like this celestial choir boy at the head of Sigur Rós. It's really, really beautiful, though, and you get a sense of how much craftsmanship is put into every second. Some of it's accidental, but some of it is also, you have, you know, everything is pristine and beautiful, and it becomes this glacial, whatever. I'm going to ask Nick to play one more song. I'm not even going to cue it up. Just play it.
Hey, little girl, is your daddy home? Did he go and leave you all alone? I got a bad
This is what I should expect from someone who loves Alvin and the Chipmunks.
It's Dolly! It's Dolly Parton, except, of course, it is Bruce Springsteen sped up to 45 from 33.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah. Yes, it is.
It's amazing how Dolly Parton comes into play, slowing down, speeding up.
You said the Jolene sounded like Nina Simone. To me, I like thinking it's a dude who, if you think about it, is kind of all, there's a little Oxycontin slur. There's a little bit of a, right there on the ish, on the pleesh. Right there.
All right. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
Hell. Hell is what's making me happy.
Okay, Glenn Weldon.
No, come on. There is, as usual, an explanation. The nine circles of Dante's Inferno, as expressed by the Romanian artist Mihai Marius, using nearly 40,000 individual Lego blocks. This has come to my attention today via the website of The Telegraph, the UK newspaper. There is, of course, a slideshow. And
I would like to think so. It'd be a journalistic right? Travesty.
Sort of a sin. Yes.
Yeah, well.
From this slideshow, you can learn a number of things, both about Dante and about Legos. One, there are a lot of gray Legos.
Yes.
Either,
I've stepped on several.
Either there are sad robot Legos that you can buy, or this guy has painted sad faces and alarmed faces and anxious faces on some robot Legos. And thirdly, it is indeed possible to render the human reproductive organs, or at least to suggest them with a surprising degree of clarity, using only Legos, if you are in the business of depicting Circle 2, which is the one where the lustful are
sure.
incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of scale. I think if you're doing it in miniature, it is harder to show every nuance of reproductive
yeah.
organs.
Yes,
but
I
if you are drawing out,
yes.
Then you have more.
Yes. So the nine circles of Dante's Hell, Mihai Marius. If I remember, I will try to provide a link to it.
So Hell is a newspaper slideshow. That makes sense to me.
All right. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
We touched on this already, but there is a wonderful documentary called 20 Feet from Stardom, which
yeah.
is about
yeah.
background singers. And Darlene Love and that whole Michigas with the Crystals and Phil Spector figures largely. It profiles Darlene Love, Mary Clayton, Lisa Fisher, Tata Vega, Judith Hill. The Waters family also appears in it. It really does trace from the Phil Spector era through the Stones, through Elton John, Talking Heads to Michael Jackson. It's just great. It is so joyous. It also really follows these people's careers. And these women have a lot in common. Many of them are preacher's daughters. Many of them know and kind of own their gifts. They know exactly how good they are. Many of them are divas who sort of luxuriate in that. Darlene Love is a great example of that, who just really, she just knows who she is. And there's a couple, and I'm going to call out Lisa Fisher here, who say that she went back from having a successful single career to being a background singer again because she didn't have the ego for being up front. And watching her in this documentary and her performative way of keeping telling you that she doesn't have an ego, I defy you to agree with her. I defy you by the end of this film. It's just that she has a different one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so she's trying to keep this whole diva thing at arm's length, even as she's sort of reveling in it. There's a moment in this film, which you will not see coming, even though I am telling you it's coming, with the Waters family, which caused me to laugh out loud and then gasp and then cough. It's great. So I highly recommend this film. 20 Feet from Stardom. It's in theaters now.
Nice. Wonderful. Thank you, Glenn. What is making me happy this week? I want to mention two things. The first is that at my beloved AFI Silver Theater this weekend, I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark
nice.
On their big yeah. on their big screen. Remember when movies were made of film? Raiders of the Lost Ark is, in case you haven't seen it in a while, especially on a big screen, still awesome. Really loses nothing, is an absolutely fantastic movie. So good, so fun, so funny, so clever. And one of the things that was really interesting watching it is that one of the things I did not get into when we talked about Elysium, because it made me feel so fogey to bring it up, is that Elysium is one of the first movies I've been to where I simply was distracted by how loud it was.
Mm.
Partly that might have just been the theater I was
yeah.
in. I was in an IMAX theater. But I think part of it is just that the accumulation of noise has just become
sort of overwhelming.
And when I saw it in the IMAX theater, there was a special IMAX-only feature, which was a Metallica video. And I literally sat there with my fingers in my ears feeling like a very, very old lady because I could not.
It was assaultively
loud. My
yeah.
chair was shaking from the sound in the theater. When I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark, this partly has to do with how the AFI treats film in theaters and that they're not trying to blow your head off. But it was so nice to see a movie that seemed scaled correctly to me in terms of the size of the screen, how much sound there was, how it was constructed. Everything in this movie feels like it's really happening, which is not always common
right.
in these films. So that's one. If you get a chance to see it, I highly recommend it. It's a fantastic movie to see. The other thing is I recently started a new sort of sub-resolution, which is I'm trying to discover new things whenever possible instead of watching more Judge Judy and stuff like that. So this weekend, I decided to try again on the show called The Midwife, which was a British show, very, very popular, highly rated. And they ran the first 6-episode season on PBS last year. And I think that I had originally seen maybe the first one and watched it and was not convinced that I wanted to watch it. And so I had kind of abandoned it. But when I was at TCA and they were talking about the next season, people were telling me, like, you really ought to watch it. You really ought to try it. So I tried it again and I watched 6 hours of it in a row. So I had a wonderful time with it. It's very charming. It's very lovely. We're going to listen to a little bit of a clip when a new midwife nurse named Chummy shows up at the convent where all of these midwife nurses live.
You need me to go through this piece by piece?
No, not remotely. What's that?
It's an enema nozzle.
It's made of glass.
Do you break things?
No.
And are all your dresses pink?
I do have another, in eau de Nil.
Bet you look a picture in that too.
So that's Chummy showing up at the convent. And there are, essentially, the way this series is structured, there's an overarching story of each of these main characters that you follow who are midwives. But then you also have kind of stories of the week where the patients that they're seeing. And so there are all these different stories about pregnant women that all turn out to be really interesting. There's some really touching, cool stuff in these first 6 episodes. It's a small season. It's streaming on Netflix. Like I said, the first time I tried it, I wasn't completely sold. But try it again. If you heard about it and you didn't try it, there's going to be a second season, which has already aired in the UK, so stay off the internet.
entirely.
But they're going to be airing it on PBS in a little while, and I strongly recommend it. I really enjoyed it a lot, and that is what is making me happy this week.
Nice.
That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPH. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer Nick Fountain, stepping in this week as usual to do a fine job with our clips. Nick Fountain, you know how to spell Nick and you know how to spell Fountain. You can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band Hello Come In provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.